Hey, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name's Brett, and I'm net control for today, Thursday, June 23rd, 2020. Actually, it's Tuesday. I said Thursday. Just seeing if you're paying attention. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is a designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with a particular emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic. We have special guest tonight, Sheila Sund, MD, who will answer your questions about COVID-19. All amateur operators are welcome to participate in COVID-19 discussions during the net. Want to try to keep our discussions around, health and science-related questions and, leaving the politics aside. There's, that's a big side of it, but it's not what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about your own try to help with your understanding of the facts, the numbers, the figures, things having to do with what's happening with the progress of this disease. Anyway, all amateur operators are welcome, but we'll start with a short check-in period. Again, if there's a lot of people, I'd like to make sure we get time to answer the questions. But if you just like to participate or maybe just listen in, I'm going to have you check in here. If you do want to ask a question and you know in advance, let me know, and I'll go ahead and highlight you. And then we're going to do a little introduction to tonight's topic by the doctor, and then we'll get to your questions. So that way I won't forget about you. When you check in, please identify with your call sign, slowly and phonetically, and also your name and location to be recognized by net control. Let's start first to see if there's anybody on Echolink that would like to check in for the emergency preparedness net. Come now, please. Okay, no one on Echolink. Let's take general check-ins for the emergency preparedness net.
Good evening, Brett. W7 November Alpha Tango, Nate.
K6 here, Tango X-ray, Dan Kaiser.
Good evening. This is Kilo Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art and Canby.
Good evening. Whiskey 7, Charlie Mike, Bruce Dundee.
Check you in. That was Bruce, Whiskey 7, Charlie Mike, preceded by Art, Kilo Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo. Dan was in there, Kilo 6, CR Tango X-ray, and Nate started us off, Whiskey 7, November Alpha Tango. Thanks for checking in. Anybody else for the emergency preparedness net?
Whiskey 7, Victor Hotel November, Frank in Lebanon.
Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray, Jay in Salem.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard Salem.
Okay, and there's another three check-ins. That was Richard, Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta. And Jay was before that, Kilo India 7, Sierra Oscar X-ray. And Frank from Lebanon there, that group, Whiskey 7, Victor Hotel November. Thank you all for checking in. Again, this is the emergency preparedness set, and we're going to talk about COVID-19. Who's out there?
Good evening, Brett. This is Chris, Alpha Echo 7, Oscar Romeo.
Record for us again tonight. Okay, did you hear me say it was Thursday instead of Tuesday? You can strike that part. Get back in there with the editor. Anyway, thanks for checking in. Anybody else for the Emergency Preparedness Net?
Last check-in, doubled with Brett.
Okay, let's have the... Sorry about that. This is KG7GDB, and I'm your net control. Let's try it again. Double.
I also heard Chris. This is Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform.
This is Alpha Echo 7, Oscar Romeo. Thanks, Brett, for hosting the net.
Okay, that's Alpha Echo 7, Oscar Romeo. Is that right? And is that Chris?
Roger, roger.
Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima Uniform, Paul, transmitting from Forest Heights, 7 miles north of Beaverton. No question.
Okay, there's Paul. Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima Uniform. See, Dan, did I recognize you? Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform. Yeah, I see you were in there. Let's see. Let's pause here for just a second with Dan. Do you have any announcements for the net, Dan?
Well, thanks, Brett. The only urgent thing I can think of is tomorrow's... let's see. No, it isn't. If we get together tomorrow at 7 p.m., it'll be for the slow scan TV. So don't miss out on that. We get started at 8 o'clock these days, and we'll probably be slowly moving that forward. The original reason for meeting at 8:30 was to avoid personal contacts that might be going on just after dinner. And it is pretty irritating, particularly the old slow scan TV. The way we're generating it these days, it's more musical and not quite so raspy. So actually, I'm getting used to it pretty much. I think most of the people using a repeater are getting used to the sound of slow scan. But I don't want it to expand out throughout the day. If there's some event that needs it, great, but let's keep the slow scan like after 8 on Wednesdays. Back to you, Brett, WA7ABU.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Does anybody else have an announcement for the net?
KE7OLU with field day.
Yes, Paul, KE7OLU. Go ahead with your announcement, please.
The ARRL field day is this coming Saturday. It's a 24-hour anywhere, get as many contacts as you can. This year with the COVID restrictions and the pandemic, social physical distancing, the ARRL has changed the rules. You can operate from home as a D station and then have your score added to your club if you put in the log entry the exact name of the club. If someone, for instance, puts in for Salem Amateur Radio Club, puts in SARC and everybody else puts in Salem Amateur Radio Club, then the SRC entry will not be included. I'll be operating from Forest Heights here in the common area, and Welcome anyone else coming in. This is KE7OLU, and I'll be operating all bands, digital and voice. Welcome to see you, and KE7OLU back to net.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Very good. Okay, so I wanted to go ahead and introduce Sheila Sund, MD. She's a local retired physician who has been studying COVID-19 since it first was showing up in January or so. She has been up on the news and has read a lot of the science behind a lot of the news reports that you hear and various announcements, and she's here tonight to answer your questions. I didn't have anybody, come up with a question right away, but what we're going to do is we're going to start with an introduction by her on the topics for tonight, and that'll probably raise some questions. So after she talks a little bit here, we'll get paused and give a chance for questions there. Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. I'm handing the mic to Sheila.
Hello, everybody. It's been about a month since I last talked to you, which is right on schedule. Those of you who were here for my last meeting said that I would come back when things had changed, and I thought that would be when cases had increased, and it was going to take roughly a month for us to see it. And guess what? We're there. So, in general, if you haven't noticed, the COVID incidence, which means the number of new cases per population group, is increasing in Oregon and throughout much of the United States. This is still the first wave. This is not a second wave. The second wave means that you've actually controlled it completely, and then it breaks out again from kind of an unsuspected place. We never controlled it, so this is still the first wave. There's been a lot of talk about whether the increase is caused by testing versus the increased amount of activity. There is no doubt that opening up is causing the increase. It's right on schedule, as pretty much all the epidemiologists as predicted. It is not explained by increased testing, and there's a number of reasons for that. One of the biggest ones is that the percent of cases of tests that are positive is also increasing, as well as the number of tests, okay? And we also know that people have wondered, well, the numbers are increasing just because there's clusters. You hear about something at a nursing home or at a food processing plant or even at a church, and you think, oh, well, that explains the increase in numbers. It doesn't. We know that community spread is now a significant part of the increase, and by definition, community spread means they got it in the community somewhere, and they don't really know where, okay? People have wondered about whether it's coming from the protests. So far, they've only identified about 50 cases nationwide that are linked to the protests, and they've not been of any part of any clusters. And if you had needed any further convincing that this is not just increased testing, hospitalizations are now increasing as well across the country, again, right on schedule. Hospitalizations increase about 14 days after the case numbers start to increase, and that's just what we're doing. The bad news is that there is nothing happening that's going to change this process. So we have not really instituted a whole lot of additional restrictions, despite recognizing that cases are increasing, with the exception that we are going to be wearing, hopefully, more masks, and that is important. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But you have to realize that just because the government has said you can go out and do certain things, that doesn't mean it's safe to do that. It doesn't mean that it won't be transmitted more when you do it, and we're seeing that. The worst problem is that we don't really know how fast it's going to go. I don't know if you remember, but this COVID thing is an exponential growth curve. And as if we were at a plateau, particularly like in Oregon beforehand, and now we're starting to climb, we're right at the beginning of that exponential growth curve. We don't know how many people each person is infecting now with our current level of social distancing. We knew before we started it averaged about 2.5 to 3 people were infected for each person with a new infection. But we don't know. Maybe it's 1.5. Maybe it's the same as it always was. What we do know is that the states like Oregon that had initially low numbers and who reopened fairly late, they're pretty early in the new curve, and even though they're increasing, it doesn't look scary. Whereas the states that opened when they had high numbers or earlier, like Texas, Florida, and Arizona, they're higher on that exponential growth curve. They're increasing faster, and it's starting to look definitely pretty scary.
Okay, KG7 GDB. So let's pause here and see if, that's the general overview. Are there any questions about that or, general sort of stuff before we get into Oregon numbers themselves? Go ahead. Okay, Richard, I'll go ahead and repeat your questions for the sake of the recording, too. Go ahead. Okay, let me just repeat that. So, so Richard's question is there a temperature-related thing like we see with the flu? Flu gets better when it gets to be hot weather. We're seeing increases in Florida and Arizona and Texas, which are warmer climates. You know, is this different than what we see with the flu with COVID? And here's Sheila.
Well, we clearly know that COVID is not killed by heat. Some of the worst outbreaks in the world, including the United States, are happening in hot places. So it is definitely different than influenza in that hot weather does not seem to decrease the ability of this virus to infect people. In addition, there may be a difference in how people get infected. Some of the increase with flu in winter time has to do with people being in closer contact with each other. And a lot of that is because when you're in cramped up together inside during the winter time, you touch more things with flu. And we know with flu that you get the illness a lot by touching things and then putting your mouth. As we've learned more about COVID, you get it more by breathing it in than by touching things. And that is not necessarily as different in the summertime as it is in winter. Now, this is just kind of theory. It's not proven. The definite thing is that hot weather isn't going to make it go away. The question would be if you also added close contact inside like you have during a typical winter flu season, would it be even worse still? And I guess we'll find that out next fall and winter.
Good question, Richard. Does anybody else have a question for Dr. Sun?
KK7ART.
K6STX.
Okay, let's do Art first and then Dan after that. Art, go ahead, Art.
In light of what you just said, do you think there's really any realistic chance that school is going to open normally in a couple months? Because at this point, I'm seriously considering homeschooling my younger two, even if they do open school, because I don't think we're even going to be out of the first wave come fall. And I was just wondering your thoughts on that. Thank you. KK7ART.
I suspect Oregon will be careful enough to not open their schools, but I honestly have to admit that even if they do open the schools, I'm not sure I would personally recommend that you send your kids back. Between the combination of we know that kids just spread illness everywhere, not just because they don't wash hands and all that kind of stuff, but because kids come in contact with more people. In general, they come in contact with other kids, with other families, et cetera. And there's been some studies of that. So I would be very nervous about anybody reopening schools from a science epidemiological point of view. That doesn't mean they won't be opened. If you asked me individually if I had a kid, would I send them to school, the answer would be no. I'd be working on homeschool with whatever online resources I could find.
Okay, good question, Art. Let's move to Dan, STX. Go ahead.
Charlie, this is Dan, K6STX. Well, I've been keeping numbers off of the numbers they've been given off of CNN. March 21st, we had 266 people passed away in the U.S. To the day, 3 months later, we're over 120,000. And, in fact, 120,271. So, almost 120,000 more. So, the question is, where do we go in another 3 months with that kind of increase?
Well, we definitely go up from what we have right now. Currently, nationwide, I think we're killing about 600 people a day from this disease. At its worst, we were managing to kill over 1,000. If we continue to let it get out of control without instituting more social distancing again, those numbers are only going to go up. Like we talked before, there's always a delay. So when the first thing that happens is just the number of positive cases go up, and then you see hospitalizations go up, and then you see deaths go up. And so there's always a month lag, basically, between cases going up and deaths going up. And that will happen again. It may be even longer this time because we are noticing that the positive cases are in younger people now. And so that means that younger people are going out and, I don't want to say breaking social distancing, but, you know, pushing, you know, having a lot more contact than older people are, and polls have suggested that's true. In general, there are a lot of people like me who are still staying at home even though technically things are open. Those tend to be people that are older and sicker or have underlying medical conditions. They are still socially distancing, whereas younger people are not. But the problem is if you increase the amount of positives in younger people, it will spread to the older people. And if you have any doubts, you can look at what happened in Sweden, because that's exactly what they did. It just takes a while to percolate. And the way to envision that is if a group of young people get sick, they hang out mostly with young people, and they get other young people sick. But some of those young people are going to eventually come in contact with people that are older. It might be their family members that they get sick. But some of those people work in healthcare settings or work in nursing homes. And all it takes is one young person working in a nursing home that has minimal symptoms or is asymptomatic, and then you have an outbreak in a nursing home, and that's when the numbers jump up really high as far as death rates. So, yes, I do think the deaths are going to go up. I think we're going to easily go back to more than 1,000 a day within just a matter of weeks. And I honestly don't know how high it can climb before we start being concerned as a country.
K7SOX with a question.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo for ID. This is the Emergency Preparedness Net, and we have Sheila Sund, MD, answering questions about COVID-19. And here's Jay. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I think of a new case as reported as somebody that wasn't infected before, and now they're infected. So what I've been told is that the new cases are actually the number of people that have been tested positive for that day. So if somebody is tested, you know, if they get infected and they're tested positive, that's a new case. If they're tested 2 days later and they're positive, that's another new case. So is that really true, or do they really keep track of for positive tests if they've already been counted as a new case?
It depends a little bit upon where you're getting your data. In most of the data that you're seeing in Oregon is positive cases, not positive tests. At least the stuff that by the time it makes it onto the big charts about, you know, how the cases are climbing over time. Now, the numbers that you see on a given day, you know, that, oh, we had 191 positives today, those have not been investigated yet, which is why if you go back and you look at the numbers from a couple weeks ago, you'll find that what they initially reported and what they report now gets tweaked in different ways. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. But the tracking we're doing to see how the epidemiology happens, that is actually based upon people that are infected, not the number of positive tests. And that is very clearly going up, as well as the number of positive tests. They just don't always hold one-on-one, particularly shortly after the data is first reported. Does that make sense?
To answer your question there, Jay.
Another way, if you find charts or graphs that look at the 7-day averages, that's a lot more helpful than looking at the numbers on any given day, because usually when you're looking at 7-day average charts and graphs, you'll be looking at actual cases, and then they will average them over the 7 days around that date. And that helps mute some of the random bumps up and down that you get depending upon, you know, did you just have a little outbreak in a nursing home or that kind of stuff. So in general, if you look at graphs that show 7-day averages of new cases, those are the most obvious ones where you can see just the nice steady increase in cases.
So when you're tested, are you asked if you've been tested before, or do the doctors know you've been tested before? I mean, how do they track the people that are already been tested versus the ones that it's a first-time test?
That happens at the state level, the Oregon Health Authority in Oregon or the equivalent in other states. And every test is labeled with a person's name. It is required by law now that if you do, whether you're a lab or a hospital or, even just one of those rapid tests, that anybody that gets tested is supposed to have full contact information and identification sent along with the test result to the state. So the state initially looks at that and tries to sort through it, which is why our data, at least in Oregon, is pretty good. Even when you see 190 new cases, that's pretty accurate. But when they truly go through it and realize, oh, this one was John R. Smith and this was John M. Smith and those were actually the same person and somebody wrote down the wrong initial, you might get some little tweaking. They actually get information on every test required by law that says who the person was, where they live, what their contact information is. Now, how fast they get it and how accurate it is, that's a different question.
Just one last question. Is there any place that that a layperson like me can find that information? Because the OHA only reports the number of positive cases.
I have a number of different places, and the one that I can quick say offhand is actually the New York Times keeps a fairly good count based upon all the sources that they can hunt down. They hunt it from state health departments, they take it from aggregate dating, they take it from modeling, and they put all those numbers together. They have pretty good data every day, and you can break it down to as low as county level. The John Hopkins site also has good information. Both of those places you have to kind of drill down a little bit to find what you're looking for, but most of them are based upon cases and often are graphed as 7-day averages.
Okay, thanks for the feedback. KI7SOX.
Question, WA7ABU.
Okay, again for ID, this is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo for the Emergency Preparedness Net with Sheila Sun, MD. Go ahead, Dan, with your question.
Recently, we've been told through the media that the Corvin virus is mutating, and basically the mutation is more spines. And
they're saying that this is not terribly alarming because everything we're working on will handle either one. But they're saying that the problem with more spines on the Corbin virus is that it's more infectious. What does that really mean to us by saying more infectious? That means that whereas before it took a drop of one size, now it takes a drop that's one quarter that size, or that it's more readily spread as you walk through a cloud presented by a infected person, or what does that really mean to us, W7ABU?
Well, mutations are fascinating with viruses. First of all, you need to realize that every virus out there is constantly mutating. I mean, literally, they mutate all the time. They replicate so quickly that the DNA process gets screwed up. But most of the mutations don't show up in any way that we really recognize. Some of the mutations, the virus doesn't survive. Some of them don't really change anything. But once in a while, you get one that either makes it look enough different that we can start identifying it when we look at them, and we usually call that a strain, or it will actually cause a change in behavior. So what we're finding is that there's been basically two strains, one that seems to be the European version and one that seems to be the Chinese version. And we've known that from fairly early on, and it's one of the ways we've been able to track how it's spread around the world. Well, it turns out the European version does have more spikes or spines, and that does mean you can get infected easier. I almost imagine just it's like a burr. It sticks to you easier. The spines are how it attaches to a cell, and if it's got the more spines, it means that it can attack a human cell earlier. So what that would mean is that theoretically, yeah, you would need a smaller number of virus particles to get sick. However, having said that, that doesn't mean that that's something we should worry about it. That's really something that we are just identifying from part of the COVID that's out there now versus another part of the COVID that's out there. The thing to me that's more reassuring is when we look at our overall numbers in the United States of, like, how many people get infected versus how many get hospitalized versus how many die. Interestingly enough, it is almost identical to what was reported in China in the very first thing. So in the United States, with our healthcare system and our population, or at least in Oregon, those are the numbers I'm really looking at, in Oregon we have 14% of the positive cases end up hospitalized and 2.5% of them die. And that's really, really similar to what was reported back in February happening in China. So even if it's becoming more infectious, it's not changing final outcomes.
Okay, well, I'll take one more question from Richard here, and then Sheila's going to talk a little bit more about another part of this, which we want to educate you guys on. So go ahead, Richard, and I'll repeat your question for the recording. Okay, so Richard's question involves comparing the numbers from China and the United States. So we have 2 million, over 2 million cases. They have 84,000. Is that a reporting problem, or is that really a better approach to the handling the viral spread? Here you go, Sheila.
Now, those numbers are real. We are not doing a good job compared to the rest of the world in controlling the United States outbreak. That's not fake data. That's not that China's hiding stuff. That's really approach to the disease. Now, China was very draconian when they got this, and they locked up like an entire equivalent of a state that was like not socially distanced like we were. We're talking like you could not leave your building without having permits. They closed down most of the country. They did really, really, really intense things. And even when they opened up, their people are tracked like crazy. So, yes, people in China, their numbers are really that low. But in exchange for that, they have marked limits on personal freedoms, and that doesn't seem to be compatible with the United States. However, if you look at other countries, they've also found ways to do it. Many of the European countries that were not the not like Italy and Spain, it hit them early before they really knew what was going on, and they weren't ready, and things got out of control. But the other countries in Europe that knew what was going on, they've controlled it with very low rates. And, for example, they currently are running at about 13 cases per 100,000 people, whereas we're over 100 in the United States per 100,000 people. And that's real data. So, the United States is not doing a good job of controlling the spread of this disease. We are more similar to what I would think of as second world countries than the majority of first world countries. Better than third world countries, but we look pretty bad compared to most of the first world countries.
Okay, thank you for your question, Richard. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. We have the emergency preparedness net with special guest Sheila Sun, MD. Now we're going to let her do another mini topic covering thing here that she's prepared for us, and then we'll take some more questions after that. Here's Sheila.
So I want to talk about shared air, because there is no doubt, as the data has continued to accumulate and the research is being done, that shared air is the single most important factor in disease transmission for COVID. It's not touching surfaces. It is what air you share with infected people. And that's why our decreased social distancing is causing so much problems. So what is safe? If you are outside in the fresh air at more than 6 feet, you are really probably safe. And even if you briefly pass through somebody else's 6-foot radius and you're outside in the fresh air, you're probably safe. But any time you are indoors, you literally have to look at the air for risk. So the risk indoors, it doesn't matter what indoor setting you're in, the risk for indoors is always going to be higher than the risk to outdoors. The volume of air matters. The larger the indoor space, the less concentrated any virus in there will be, and the less likely you are to get infected. So you are safer in a big grocery store than you are in a little boutique. Ventilation to the outside helps a lot. The best thing is lots of open windows or open doors with air that you can feel moving through. So if you're in a building that's more like it's got a roof but all the sides are open, that pretty much counts as outdoors. Somewhere like all the windows in your house being open, that's better. But if you think a lot about our retail spaces, they do not have a lot of ventilation, and very few ventilation systems were ever built to vent to the outside in the first place. So, but if you do look at ventilation, that matters. So that's the space. But the bigger problem with shared air is who is sharing the air with you. And so you have to look, if you're going to go into an indoor space, you have to look at several things. The first thing is how many people have been in the space, okay? The more people that have been in the space, the greater the risk. And that's the number of people that have been in the space over the last several hours, not just the time that you're in the room. So an air first thing in the morning when nobody has been there is going to be safer indoor air than the same indoor air late in the afternoon where people have been coming and going. Okay? The longer people spend in the space, the greater the risk as well. They say 15 minutes, that's kind of a made-up number, but generally, people that come and go very quickly, 5 or 10 minutes, probably are not putting a lot of virus into the air. And so indoor spots where people come and go quickly, they go in and buy a single loaf of bread, grab a to-go order, something like that. Those are probably pretty safe, whereas people that are going in there and spending an hour or two because it's a restaurant or a barbershop or a salon or a gym, those places are much higher risk. And then lastly, the type of breathing going on in this space matters. So people that are quiet, a library, is going to have much lower risk. And if you kind of look at the amount of breathing going on, the safest is people that aren't talking, and then it goes to quiet talking, loud talking, shouting, exercising, singing, coughing, and sneezing. So if you had to go to a salon where nobody talks because everybody in there speaks a different language, that's going to be a lot safer than the community barter shop where everybody's catching up on the gossip. So if you have to go indoors, those are things you can remember for yourself. But I think this can also show why it's getting so much worse in throughout the country. If we are allowing people to go back to gyms and get their hair done and go to restaurants, those are relatively small spaces. They don't have great ventilation. They have a fairly large number of people compared to the amount of space, and people are there for a long time and often talking. Churches can be even worse. They're bigger spaces, but there's often even more people, and they're often talking loudly and singing. So that's why you are seeing the general increases that you're increasing. The other thing I want to talk about is the concept of a super spreader, because we've shown now on some good epidemiology studies that if you look at everybody that has had this disease, about 4 out of 5 infected people, those are what we consider normal infectors. They will infect 1 to 3 other people. And they result in what we call community spread, meaning we don't know where people got sick, okay? Those 1 to 3 people that they infect could be in a store, a restaurant, their household, at their workplace, but they're only going to give it to 1 to 3 other people. And generally, our contact tracing sucks at identifying who they might have given it to. Those are the cases that result, however, in that exponential growth curve, because if each person infects 2 others or 3 others, you can see how over a month those numbers are going to go up. However, 1 in 5 infected people seem to be what we call super spreaders, and we can't identify them, and we don't know why it is, but instead of infecting 1 to 3 others, they, in the same amount of time, can infect 10 to 80 other people, okay? They just spew the stuff out there. They don't seem to be coughing, sneezing, blowing in people's faces, any of that. They're just really good at putting large amounts of infectious virus out there. So when you see a cluster in a workplace, a restaurant, a church, most of those places where it's happened pretty quickly, that was probably because a super spreader got in there. And that creates a sudden peak because all of a sudden one restaurant has 10 people, 15 people that are sick. One church has 230. So what they do is they cause these huge peaks. They don't necessarily change the overall curve if you can find all of those peaks they infected, those people we infected. And we're better at finding them. So if you have an outbreak at a workplace, contact tracing works pretty good. You check everybody in the workplace, you find all of them, you isolate them and all their household members, and it's pretty good. And we know where it came from, and we manage to squelch those. Even though they make the numbers jump up, we can control those. As far as your own risk, if you come in contact with 4 out of 5 infected people, you're never going to know where you got infected. You won't know whether it was somebody that you saw in the grocery store or were at a restaurant or who knows. You're probably not going to be able to figure it out and know well anyone else. However, if you happen to go to a restaurant and you have the bad luck to be in the restaurant when there's a super spreader there, you'll then be part of a cluster. And so this is a really different way of looking at disease transmission than we've ever considered before. But it's becoming increasingly true that we see this low level of constant spread from the standard people that are infected, and then we get these super spreaders. And your risk is entirely a flip of a coin. Are you with a 4 out of 5 people that are going to spread it to just 1 or 3, or do you have the bad luck to be in the same room as a super spreader?
Okay, Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. So pause there for any other questions about what you just talked about there, about this mechanism of spreading or super spreaders and the shared air concepts.
Yeah, K6SDX.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of now that we got summertime and you're going to go to different places where they have air conditioning because they got all the windows and doors all closed up. Now, is that actually going to make things worse?
Most definitely. Air conditioning systems work by recirculating the same air, and they often, interestingly, create certain currents. So not only does it recirculate the COVID air for a longer period of time than it would be if you didn't have an air conditioning system, but depending upon where you happen to be in the air current, if you can feel it blowing on you, man, I would be nervous because we've been able to show in certain office settings and restaurant settings that, yeah, people get in a certain air path and they get infected all along that path. So, yeah, I honestly don't go in indoor places for more than 5 minutes, and even that only under duress.
Okay, and there's Richard. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo, your net control for the emergency preparedness net. Go ahead, Richard. I'll just repeat that. Question is about airplane air filtration systems. Is it any better now than it was? Is it applied to the same sort of stuff, recirculating the same air, increasing the risk? Here you go. Here's Sheila.
I'm not an expert by any means on airplanes, but I do have to go regularly to Los Angeles now to handle my mom's estate. She passed away in April, and so I would love nothing more to get on an airplane. I'm not brave enough to do so. I think the risk is too high. However, from the air perspective, from what I have read, yes, airplanes actually have a better air filtration system than exists in most places. And a lot of that was present even before COVID came along. So your shared air in an airplane is probably not the entire airplane. It's probably the people around you that you're sharing air with. But by the time it circulates throughout the whole airplane, I think it does have a better level of cleaning. Is it adequate or not? Don't know. So far, we haven't had clusters reported on airplanes. We've had single, you know, small cases, like, you know, the 1 to 3 people get infected kind of thing, but we haven't had clusters. That doesn't make me confident enough yet to want to get on an airplane, however.
W7CCM.
Okay, and this is something Bruce knows about, the aeronautical engineer there. CCM, go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, your aircraft, you're drawing in outside air and mixing it, the aircraft pressurization and air conditioning packs, what they call a pack. It's a multiple systems that draw heated air off the engines and external air from the outside and mix that, obviously. So, the bleed air heat and outside air then is circulated, is heavily filtered, then it's circulated through the cabin and exhausted through an output valve. So the entire air content of your cabin on a very large aircraft even is exchanged approximately every 2 minutes. So that's not bad. That's pretty good. Can that be improved? Yeah, marginally, but that's a pretty high rate of performance. Like Sheila says, the risk is from somebody sitting adjacent to you or standing in the aisle or something of that nature. W7CCM.
And that gets back to the concept of 6 foot distancing. The problem with shared air in most places like a restaurant, a store, a bar, is beyond the 6 feet. That's why our regulations about restaurants being at 50% capacity and everybody has to be about 6 feet, it makes the numbers lower than they would be, but everybody in that restaurant is still sharing the air to some degree, unless it's got some wonderful, great filtration system or all the windows are open. But if you are sitting within 6 feet of somebody, that is like breathing in their breath all the time, and I don't care what your air is. You can be outdoors, and if you're sitting right next to them, you're breathing somebody's air and their virus. So within 6 feet, it doesn't matter. It's a bad thing to be within 6 feet of somewhere in where or out. And in an airplane, you're always sitting within 6 feet of people. So those are the people that you're at most risk of in an airplane, no matter how good their air system is. My concern is, again, if you think about everywhere that we go indoors, is you can stay 6 feet away, but if you are sharing the air, you're sharing their breath, because it doesn't get exchanged in most indoor settings the way it does on an airplane or the way it does outside.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. So any other questions about the super spreader concept? And that's fascinating. Remember, that what she's, just to reiterate what she's saying, is that when you see a cluster, you know, this is one of those things that, you know, you might see reported in the news that, oh, a nursing home has a big outbreak or cluster, okay? But, you know, those are different than those, at least the theory is that that might have been caused by a super spreader, as opposed to the overall numbers in the community, which are the community spread people. So any questions about that? That's fairly new information, and if you get it, you know, you guys are pretty smart. You've been listening every week now for a while, so I give you a lot of credit for knowing this stuff already. But any other questions about the super spreader idea? Let's see, are there any other questions that have come to mind that we haven't talked about yet? I can also take a couple of check-ins. We've only actually checked in 12 people, so I hope there's more people listening than who's here. We haven't taken a lot of time for check-ins, but if anybody has a question that hasn't checked in, you're welcome to check in and ask a question.
Well, I don't have any questions I want to ask, but I will check in. It's Kilo Juliet 7 India Bravo Hotel, Gerard and Lebanon.
Okay, there's Gerard, Kilo Juliet 7, India Bravo Hotel. Welcome. So, other questions that discussion brought up? If not, we can talk a little bit more about specifically about Oregon, or we can talk about contact tracing, which is something that I brought up last time that, you know, people had some questions about fake contact tracing, but one of the things that came up before the net, we had a question from Jaeger who was asking about what do these contact tracer guys actually ask you about, and how do you know whether it's real or not, and are they asking you pertinent questions about, you know, your behavior, like, you know, where you've been and if you've attended any rallies or, you know, that kind of thing. So I can move on to that. If anybody has would like to move to that, we can do that, or if there's any other questions, just pop up right now. Otherwise, we'll talk about that a little bit.
Kilo Juliet 7 India Tango Zulu.
Okay, I've got Kilo Juliet 7 India Tango Zulu, and you've checked in before. That is Brian, is that correct?
Indeed. Thanks, Brett. Yeah, I do have a question. I guess I didn't catch on the tail.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
So the data listed on the CDC, would we consider that to be accurate as opposed to what is heard in the media? Because I can draw a whole lot of different conclusions by looking at the CDC data.
Okay, here's Sheila.
I hate to say this, but the CDC data is probably one of the least accurate things that we have in this country. Mostly because they are dependent upon what the state health departments send them, and the state health departments each have their own way, sometimes with political overtones, of how they report what's happening in their state. If you
okay, so looking at the state levels would be some more of what's going on, but the thought is that what we're seeing is that people are infected, but not necessarily sick and not necessarily dying, because somebody that gets infected doesn't necessarily die. And the data that I see on the CDC is pretty much all skewed to show that anybody 45 and older is going to die from COVID.
They do a very, very good job of trying to drill down to the data. They don't just take the state reports, they actually get data as reported by individual counties and testing centers and a variety of that. There are a couple media places that do that as well. Again, I like the New York Times one. They basically use all of their investigative reporting staff to try and hunt down lots and lots and lots of different data sites. So the more different data sites you're using to create your projections, the better you're going to be. And unfortunately, the government ones don't actually do that. So the government sites are the least reliable site, and the more congregate they are, i.e. Federal versus state, the least accurate they are.
W7NAT, that last transmission, first half of it was a double, with Sheila winning.
Okay, so let's see. So you need a fill. The first part was a double, or the last part there?
The first part of what she talked, the whole thing she said.
Okay, well, let's have her summarize it again here. Hang on.
Okay, in summary, the CDC data is one of the least accurate places to get your information from. The CDC reports aggregate data from the states, yet the way each state collects it and what they choose to send on is determined at a state level, and it varies all over the map. Some states are very accurate, some are less. Some that's because of resources, some that's because of politics. The bottom line is, yeah, it's just the government sites are actually your least helpful sites at this point in time. Your most helpful site is going to some of the university ones, particularly the Johns Hopkins one is very good. I also have done a lot of data drilling on the New York Times one and have been pretty impressed at how well that seems to match the actual data sets that are published in varying places if you go and hunt them down. So those are my two favorite places is Johns Hopkins and New York Times, but there are multiple other ones. I use the government ones with caution.
Okay, so sorry about the double there. Was there a question that... Okay. Good. All right. So let's have Sheila talk a little bit more about the next pop.
About if they want to do it, we'll talk about contact tracing.
Okay. So actually, she's. Yeah, she wants to, actually we're just about out of time. We won't go over contact tracing, but just, you know, we can talk about that next time, perhaps, if you have questions about it. But we are at 8 o'clock, so she did want to have a final comment here for you guys, so I'll hand it over again. This is, again, Kilo Golf, 7 Golf, Delta Bravo, and here's Sheila Sund.
Okay, you're going to get a little bit of me being frustrated in this statement. because it is both in Oregon and in California. It's very frustrating to see how much people are doing and to see how little we care about the fact that we are already killing 600 people a day in this country and the numbers are going up. So I'd like to remind you that when you choose to go places that have risk, as I've defined it, with shared air, you're not just endangering yourself, you are endangering others. Because this virus spreads by people coming in contact with each other. When we weren't doing that, the numbers were great. As we are sharing more spaces, the numbers are increasing, and they're going to continue to do so. So I would really encourage you to not go share air unless it's truly essential, not just to keep yourself safe, but because when you do, you're endangering others. I had a friend that I saw in L.A., and they said, oh, well, we're all going to die of something. You could get killed when you cross the street. And my answer was yes, but when you get killed crossing the street, you're only killing yourself. If you go out and you share air with a bunch of people, you are endangering a large number of other people, and you're basically saying that you don't care if this gets into nursing homes and kills people. And so I would please beg of you to be cautious where you go, not just to take care of yourselves, but to take care of the greater community who can't all, they don't all have those choices. If you live in a nursing home, you're stuck. If you work in a food processing plant, you're stuck. The best we can do to help keep those deaths down is by socially distancing, even if our government is letting us do more. So there's me on my high horse, and I'm done for the day.
Okay, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and that's kind of a follow-up to if, you know, if one of the things that was people had said is that, well, you know, things are getting better, right? The government's, dropping these restrictions. COVID's better now, right? And it's not better. that's clearly the case. Don't equate the changes and going back in phases with things getting better. It's getting less restrictive, but the disease is still there. We have not done anything to do the disease, and now it's getting worse again. So there you go. Sorry about that. Anyway, I think most of us that have been following this all along, we've been being really good. I think you guys are a fantastic community of hams, and you ask great questions, and we're problem solvers, and I know you guys are being safe out there, but you'll have something to say when people tell you, oh, it's all, you know, whatever. You've heard a couple of excuses there now, like, it doesn't matter, I'm going to die from something sometime, you know. You can tell them that, don't take anyone else with you, please. Anyway, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and I guess we're at the end of the emergency preparedness net for this evening, and I need to close out the net here. The time is now 8:03 p.m., and this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. There will be a recording available of tonight's discussion at the WA7ABUgroups.io page. This net meets each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 MHz. Our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thank you to our guest, Sheila Sund, MD. Thanks to all who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear frequency. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf, Delta Bravo, now clearing the net at 8:04 p.m. We now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. Okay, AG7, GDB, clear.
There's more listening out here than checked in, W1ARK.
Okay, Robert, I got you logged anyway there. You're only number 15, Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo.
That's what's known as a lurking, K6STX. You're probably good at that, Robert.
Sounds like you're a pretty good lurker yourself.
K6STX.
You're quite right. I've gone here quite a bit, K6STX.
Yeah, I like to lurk.